Paul turns his attention in Ephesians chapter 5 to husbands. Now, in verses 22 and 23 and 24 that we've looked at over the last 2 weeks, Paul dealt with a wife's role in marriage. And we talked about that, and we looked at the origin of roles in the Bible, and it's on your recap, and we won't go through that again. But Paul deals with wives and their responsibility in marriage. Now, Paul turns his attention, starting in verse 25, to men. I want to point out something, first of all. Do you notice that what Paul has to say about men is about 3 times longer than what he says to women? Women he deals with in about 3 verses. Men he takes about 8 or 9 verses to deal with their responsibilities. And so Paul has a lot to say to men in marriage. Now, it can be summarized this way, and if you write anything down, I hope you will write this down, men. You and I, as Christian husbands, are to exercise loving servant leadership. If our wife's role is to submit in the marriage relationship under God and as a service to Jesus Christ, your role and my role as Christian men in marriage is to exercise loving servant leadership. Now, how will we know what that loving servant leadership is? Paul describes it in 4 ways in this passage. First of all, we're going to see in verse 25 that we're going to begin to look at today that it is sacrificial love. Sacrificial love patterned after the love of Jesus Christ for the church. Secondly, we'll see in this passage that it is nurturing love. Thirdly, it is caring love. And last but not least, it is committed, exclusive love. All right? So that's where we're going, men. Paul says that our responsibility in marriage is to exercise loving servant leadership that's seen through sacrificial love, caring love, nurturing love, and exclusive, committed love. Now, one writer said this about Paul, what Paul has to say in verses 25 through 32. Paul turns to the reciprocal duties of the husband. In Greco-Roman society, it was recognized that wives had obligations to their husbands, but not vice versa. I can't emphasize that enough. When Paul talks to husbands in this passage, he is being revolutionary. He's being revolutionary in turning to men and saying, by the way, you have some responsibilities in marriage. You have some duties to carry out in marriage. You see, the whole of Greco-Roman society said women have the duties, women have the responsibilities for their husband, for their marriage, for their families. But men get off the hook. Paul turns that around. As this writer says, in Greco-Roman society, it was recognized that wives had obligations to their husbands, but not vice versa. In this, as in other respects, Christianity introduced a revolutionary approach to marriage that equalized the rights of wives and husbands and established the institution as a much firmer, on a much firmer foundation than ever before. Paul begins instructing husbands in verse 25 by saying, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Now, I want you to see a couple of things here as we introduce this whole topic. Number one, you notice Paul's instruction, this first part of this loving servant leadership, Paul's instructions to men is that their love must be sacrificial. Sacrificial based on the pattern of Jesus Christ. You'll also notice that Paul does not say, husbands, command your wives. Did you notice that, guys? It doesn't say anywhere, husbands, command your wives. What does it say? Husbands, don't be afraid. It's not a trick question. Husbands, love your wives, not command your wives. The second thing I want you to see about this passage is a man's love for his wife is not connected to his wife's submission. I actually had a Christian man say to me once that he didn't have to love his wife because she wasn't submissive to him, and that comes first in the passage. You can imagine what that does to a marriage. I'm here to tell you that's not true. Not only are men never told to command their wives, they're told to love their wives, but that love is irrespective of their wives' submission. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to let wives off the hook as I'm not trying to let men off the hook. Husbands, okay? I'm not trying to let anybody off the hook here. Wives, the Scripture says that you ought to submit to your husband, that there is a role for you in the family as there is a role for your husband in the family, and that you should carry out that role because when you do it, you're serving Christ. That's what Paul said in Ephesians 5, 22, 23, and 24. When you do that, you're submitting to Christ. When you do that, you're serving Christ. So you ought to maintain your role, the role God assigned you in marriage. But that doesn't leave your husband off the hook if you don't. He still must love you, and vice versa. You must submit to him even if he's not loving you properly. Peter deals in 1 Peter 3 where a wife is married to an unchristian husband, a non-Christian. A non-Christian husband doesn't submit to Christ. And yet, in that passage in 1 Peter 3, and I don't have time, you can look it up. Please not during the sermon. Peter instructs that wives, Christian wives married to non-Christian husbands, ought to also still submit. So the one isn't dependent on the other. So Paul doesn't say to men, command your wives. He says, love your wives, and that love is not connected to their submission. It would make it easier as a husband's love of his wife will make submission easier. It always does. Whenever God's order is followed in the home, things become easier. Now, by the way, we are sinful, fallen creatures, so they'll never be perfect. I'm not saying that. Right? One writer said this, the exhortation is to mutual love and devotion and in no way suggests that a man has a right to make a slave of his wife. That's not what Paul means by a husband being the head of the wife. It's not what Paul means when he talks about these roles in marriage. There's never any thought that a husband can command or make a slave of his wife. All right, now, Paul says, verse 25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So we ought to ask ourselves, well, what does he mean by love? What is the word that's translated love in English? What does the Greek word mean? How will we know that love if we see it? All right? Well, there were four words in Greek. They're not all used in the New Testament, but there were four words used in Greek at the time of Paul to speak of love and different kinds of love and, if you will, different levels of love. Now, I have to tell you, it's just like in English and any other language, these are general distinctions. When I'm going to share with you these four different Greek words and then tell you which one Paul uses here in this passage, these are general distinctions. It doesn't mean that the meanings don't sometimes bleed into each other, but generally speaking, there are these four Greek words translated love, and they describe four different kinds of love. Now, I'm going to share with you from two sources. I'm going to share with you from C.S. Lewis. He has a tape series called The Four Loves that's still available. And it's kind of really neat because you hear Lewis teaching in his own voice. It's just exciting to think that you can still, you know, there's still recordings out there of Lewis's own voice. He's been gone from us for a long time. But it's called The Four Loves, and he goes through these four different Greek words for love. The second source that I'm borrowing from this morning, and in fact I'm going to quote extensively from in the rest of our time together this morning, is from a book entitled Becoming One. It's several decades old now, and it's by a gentleman by the name of Don Meredith. Now, how many of you remember the early days of Monday Night Football? Okay, only a handful, but there are more than I expected. And when Monday Night Football began, it was the big deal, right? And one of the commentators was Dandy Don Meredith. That's not the Don Meredith I'm quoting this morning. I just want you to understand that. I'm not quoting Dandy Don Meredith this morning. All right, this is a different Don Meredith, a family therapist. Okay, now, I'm going to be quoting from his book, Becoming One, which I think still is a really helpful book. And I'm going to be sharing with you from what Lewis says about these four words. Now, Lewis deals with all four Greek words for love, whereas Meredith only deals with three of the four. All right? Now, not all four of these words are found in the New Testament. And we'll get that as we go through these. Why is this important? Let me kind of set the stage for why this is important, that we understand the kind of love Paul is calling husbands to exercise toward their wives. And I want to do it by quoting from Meredith from his book, Becoming One. He says this, much of the problem in marriage in America, and he's talking about how many marriages fail. He says this, much of the problem stems from America's definition of the word love. In the world, combinations of circumstances almost totally determine love. Feelings, the need for emotional and sexual attention, social status, escape from home, school, financial or social pressure, aging and desire for children are some of the reasons people get married. With the right combination or lineup of influences, couples say, I think I'm in love, let's get married. He goes on to say, all of these circumstances exist certainly, but they cannot produce love. That's important. They cannot produce love. Couples considering marriage must settle in their minds what real love is before getting married. See? So if you're here this morning, well, you are here, I see you. Okay? That's a silly statement if you're here this morning, okay? Where does stuff like that come from? You are here this morning, but you may not be married, okay? And you're saying, well, you know, this doesn't matter to me. I don't have to listen to this. I wish I had gone to the lake this morning. Whatever, okay? You need to know this, Christian men and women, especially if you're looking forward to being married. And what he says here is so true. Couples considering marriage must settle in their minds what real love is before getting married. And then he goes on to say this, and this is the most one of the most astounding statements I have ever read in print. And it's astounding. He says, it is sad that some of the greatest love relationships you know of could be destroyed by a change in circumstances. Let me say that again so you get the full weight of that. It is sad that some of the greatest love relationships you know of could be destroyed by a change in circumstances. What does he mean? Well, I'll quote some more in a second, but let me try to illustrate a little bit. If you got married based on the other person's looks, if you get married because she is a knockout, and she ought to be, you know, to you, she ought to be. There's nothing that will ever happen to a man that's more precious than when he stands up in front of a church and looks to the back of the church and see his bride come through that door. She is the most beautiful creature in the world. Nothing can compare with that. But if all you're getting married, if all you're marrying is looks, you're in for trouble. Why is that? Because people do what I did. They get older. They lose their looks. I can't understand why every time I look in a mirror anymore, and I try to avoid it as much as possible, but any time I look in a mirror anymore, my father's looking back at me. How does that happen? I weighed 135 pounds in seminary. Soaking wet. I'm a little more than that today. I had hair. Kathy has a picture of me that she loves, and I love it too because it reminds me of the day when I actually had something up here. And it's full, and it's bushy, and it's longer than I ever thought. I don't know how they got me to get through seminary with hair that looked like that. If you get married to somebody because of their looks are going to change. What happens when their looks change? What happens when you've spend a few years together. What happens when they put on some pounds? I was sharing with the first service, I was kind of astounded. There was a sports figure who was the sports guy for one of the local local TV stations in Dallas when I was in seminary. And he wasn't like matinee idol handsome, okay? But he was a good-looking guy, svelte, you know, thin, and the kind of guy you expect to see on television. Well, yesterday we're watching one of the games. Now, this guy still commentates. Now, we're talking about 30-plus years later. This guy still comments on games. He's one of the commentators, and he was on one of the disappointing games I watched yesterday because the team I wanted to win lost. But anyhow, he was the commentator, and I had heard his voice, and he has a compelling voice. I love to hear his voice. But right before the game started, they put him on camera, and I went like this. He must be at least 100 pounds more than he was back in the late 70s, early 80s when we were in Dallas. At least, if not 150. But that tends to happen as you grow older. You get a little more around the middle, a little less around the top. Things change. If you marry a person because of the way they look or because they are sexy, and they ought to be sexy to you, but if you marry a person for that reason, what happens when they lose that? Or what happens when somebody else comes along who is sexier or better looking? That's not a basis for marriage. Meredith goes on to say this, if one changes from rich to poor, sexy to unsexy, young to old, social to unsocial, athletic to unathletic, healthy to unhealthy, skinny to fat, faithful to unfaithful, spiritual to unspiritual, most people would lose what they define as love. That's sad. With counterfeit love, he says, circumstances and performance are very important. So many people's love, the love that they marry on, is based on circumstances and based on the performance of their mate. When the circumstances change or the performance isn't present, what happens? They fall out of love. So as Meredith says, we need to pursue commitment love, not feelings and circumstances. All right? So let's look at these four kinds of love. The first is called storge in Greek. And it's according to C.S. Lewis, it means love or affection, especially of parents for children, of the love of the ruled people for a ruler, and those of you who are pet lovers will like this, of the love of dogs for their master. Storge is used of the love of dogs for their master. When that dog comes running to you and they just want to be petted and they're just, you know, wiggling all over the place, that's storge. They're exhibiting to you storge. Okay, that's that word. The second kind of love, and the first one that Don Meredith deals with, is called eros. Eros. Meredith calls this lust love. Lust love. C.S. Lewis defines it as love mostly of sexual passion, passionate joy. There's nothing wrong with eros within marriage. There ought to be eros in marriage. There ought to be that kind of sexual passion in marriage. If you don't have it, something's wrong with your marriage. There ought to be that in marriage, the sexual passion. That ought to be a part of marriage. But if you're basing your marriage on sexual passion, there's a problem. You eventually have to talk to each other. That's eros, or what Meredith calls lust love. He says this, and I'm quoting, the first level he deals with is eros. This kind of love is totally emotional and physical, with emphasis on meeting the desires of the one who loves. In other words, it's pointed toward me. Sexual attraction, lust love, he calls it. Sexual attraction and involvement are primary. Eros love is ultimately a self-centered or selfish love. Many couples today get married with an eros love as the focal point, and most do not even know it. Why are so many of these marriages ending in divorce? Because eros love is selfish. Now, please understand me. I want you to understand what I'm saying and where I'm coming from and where the Bible's coming from. Eros, love within marriage, is good. But it is not the basis for a marriage. It is not the reason or circumstance to get married. It should be present. There should be that passion. But it's not the basis for a marriage. The third word, the second one that Meredith deals with, is the word phileo. Phileo in Greek, which C.S. Lewis describes this way, it's affectionate regard, friendship, usually between equals, of friendship between states, of friendship with a wise man. So the emphasis in phileo is the idea of, as Meredith says, mutual love. It's attraction or affection. Okay. Now, again, that ought to be present in a marriage relationship. Meredith says this, phileo describes mutual tender affection between two people. It has the connotation of brotherly love. In contrast with eros love, mutual love would be a key phrase here. It has the idea of appreciation of the total person, not just the sexual person, but the total person. I love you because you love me describes phileo love. Do you get it? I love you because you love me. Circumstances, performance is behind phileo love. Meredith says this, the overwhelming majority of marriages in America are a combination of eros and phileo love. Now that brings us to the fourth kind of love. And it's the word that Paul uses in Ephesians 5:25 when he says, husbands, love your wives. It's the word agapao or agape love. Agapao or agape love. Now, Meredith says this, the third level, love is far superior to either of the other two. This is agape, and it is described in Scripture primarily as the kind of love that God gave to His Son and then to man. This kind of love is the opposite of eros in that it is totally sacrificial. This love can only be measured by the sacrificial action of the giver. It is not primarily emotional or sexual because it is drawn out not by the attractiveness of the object love, but by the commitment of the giver. And that's why he calls it commitment love. That's the kind of love Paul's talking about that men should have for their wives in Ephesians 5:25, a commitment love. Love that loves the other person regardless of the circumstances. That loves the other person regardless as if they please me. And so he calls this a commitment love. He says this, the lover is acting in obedience to God's command. Therefore, the love is God-directed. It is first an issue between God and man, not between two people. And it does not always run with the natural inclinations of feelings. This love, in other words, you love even though you don't feel the love. Okay? With other love, eros love, or storge love, or with phileo love, you feel love toward the other person. You feel an attraction toward the other person. You feel something toward the other person. Agape love's not based on that. It's first an issue between God and man, not between two people, and it does not always run with the natural inclinations of feelings. Now, the thing to understand is that when you love with an agape kind of love or agapao kind of love, the other ones follow. You say, well, I'm at the stage of my life or the stage of my marriage where I'm not feeling the eros anymore. Or not like I used to. Or you're saying I'm at the stage of life or the stage of my marriage where I'm not feeling the phileo anymore, the affection that I once felt. What I'm here to tell you and what the Scripture is teaching is that if you will exercise commitment love, agape type love, the feelings, the eros, and the affection will follow that. You know, I don't believe that. Well, you don't have to believe me. That's the Scripture. I like what Howard Hendricks used to always say. If you can't take it any other way, take it by faith. if you exercise commitment love, if you're at that place in your marriage, and it can come early in your marriage, it can come later in your marriage, if you're at that place where you're saying, I don't feel the eros anymore, I don't feel the phileo anymore, the friendship, affection, then I'm telling you, what you've got to do is exercise the commitment love. The commitment love. And at a point, the others will return. Meredith says this, this love is responsible and does not change as feelings change. This love is responsible and does not change as feelings change. Now, I want to spend just a few minutes here. He develops some thoughts about agape love from 1 Corinthians 13. That's the great love passage. How many of you know 1 Corinthians 13? Okay? Love is this, love is this, love is not this, love is not this. That's the passage. It's the one that too many people put in a plaque on their wall and not enough in their hearts and in their lives. Okay? He deals with just five aspects of this agape love that Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 13. I'm going to share with you real quickly what he says. Number one, as the King James says, love suffers long. In the NIV, it's love is patient. That's what it means by suffering long. Love is patient. Meredith says this. This is the quality of enduring offense from your mate, even though there is a tide of emotion welling up within you demanding that you retaliate. In other words, agape love is the kind of love that doesn't flash back at your mate. It's the kind of love that though you have been offended and your mate either offended you accidentally or maybe they meant to offend you, but you don't retaliate. That is agape love. It's patient or suffers long. The application, he makes application, he makes two applications here. Number one, have the kind of patience that waits and prays for the reformation of your mate rather than flying out in resentment. So usually that's what happens. We get into that downward spiral where we just start to throw out put-downs at each other. Man, I think it's your job as the head of your home to stop that cycle if you get into it. I think both of you, either one of you should stop it. But men, if you don't stop it, you're really in trouble with God, I think. The second application he makes is this love suffers many slights and neglects from the person it loves, but waits to see the kindly effects of such patience on them. The second aspect of love he deals with is, as King James puts it, love is not easily provoked, or as the NIV says, love is not easily angered. Meredith says this, love does not become bitter or resentful as a result of continuous irritation or offenses. And love will not respond to these offenses with touchiness or anger. There are lots of little irritations in marriage, right? Anybody who's been married for any period of time, if you want to be honest, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, I don't want you in trouble at lunch today, okay? Will admit that there are lots of irritations, both small and large, that occur in marriage. Some of them are just totally ridiculous. He squeezes from the end of the toothpaste tube. She squeezes from the center. Who's right? Well, Colgate toothpaste used to have instructions, believe it or not, on how to squeeze their tube of toothpaste. It said squeeze it from the end toward the... That's what it said, okay? I looked, it's not there anymore. They probably get in a lot of trouble with a lot of... if you're having that battle, do one of two things. Get one of those things that you slide on the toothpaste thing that slides the toothpaste up, or buy two tubes. They're not expensive. For $1.86, you can each have your own tube and squeeze till your heart's content. Okay? That's a kind of a, you know, and I think God has a sense of humor. I've shared this with you before. I think God puts door openers together with door closers. What do I mean by that? I think that in almost every couple, one of you, when you open a door, don't know how to go the other direction. Oh, you mean they close too? I never knew that. And I guarantee that your mate knows it closes and knows that you never close it. I can't believe it. I walked into the kitchen. Four cabinet doors are open. What's the need of four cabinet doors open? I have no idea. Or it could be drawers, and you're negotiating around the drawers, you know. You know, if you're the one that drives you up a wall, do me a favor. Don't get divorced over it. Just close the drawer and the door. I'm serious. Is it worth putting down your mate to battle over that day after 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 day? Love's not easily provoked. His application: a weakness or offense in your mate should not cause bitterness or anger in you. Third, real quickly, love bears all things. NIV, love always protects. Meredith says this: love endures offenses from your mate and throws a cloak of silence over your suffering so that the offenses of your mate are not divulged to the world. How many husbands and wives, they get into a battle with their mate, and what do? They tell their buddies. Can't believe what she did. They call mom and dad. This guy is something else. Never thought he was going to turn out like this. Love always protects. It throws, as he says, a cloak of silence over what's happening so the offenses of your mate are not divulged to the world. His application is this: if you have a non-Christian or a non-spiritual spouse, while this may be known to godly leaders in your church, this should not be exposed in casual prayer groups. Your mate needs to be able to trust you. Go to a church leader, an elder, your pastor. Don't go to the girl next door unless the girl next door or the guy next door is your BFF. Okay? And you share all those things. And even then, I'm not so sure that's a good idea. Love believes all things. Always trusts, as the NIV says. Love chooses to believe the best about your mate and always assumes his or her motives and intentions are right. The application is twofold. We make people what we believe them to be. If we indicate that we suspect them, they will be untrustworthy. To trust in your mate, give him or her a feeling of self-worth and acceptance, a key to effecting change in your mate. Last, because I'm really out of time. Love endures all things, or as the NIV says, love always perseveres. Meredith says this: love has the power to enable one to endure any trial with a confident and joyful heart. Trials produce perseverance and blessings from God. The application is this: divorce is not a manifestation of the love that endures all things. The essence of love is permanent commitment. One commentary describes or defines this word perseverance as love that remains steadfast in the face of unpleasant circumstances. I want to tell you, as a couple, you will face many circumstances in your life together. Some relatively soon, some may take decades to develop. And the kind of love that Paul is calling husbands too, especially, and the Bible is calling couples to, is the kind of love that is a permanent commitment to one another as the seasons of your lives change. Now, we'll have a lot more to say about this, and we'll explore what it means when Paul says to love your wives as Christ loved the church. We've got to ask ourselves, well, how did he love the church? We're going to ask ourselves that next week.